throughout the country, 90% of cities, states, are going to go bankrupt within the next 5 years, and probably many of them sooner.
Hi, I'm Tim Cavanaugh from Reason TV. We're here with former Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon. Your Honor, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You've been hitting the streets a lot and publishing op-eds and making the argument that municipal bankruptcy might be the way forward for cities such as Los Angeles and maybe specifically for Los Angeles. Can you elaborate on why that would help a city in distress?
Well, right now, the pensions that the city of Los Angeles has to pay every year go up about $500 million a year. And this year, they just barely got by. Next year, they're going to have to come up with an additional $500 million. And I don't know where they're going to get it. They've stolen from every nook and cranny of the city. And if they get it next year, by some miracle, they won't get it the year after. So my prediction is one of two things are going to happen. One is that they're going to have to come up with a restructuring of the whole pension plan and everything in the city or go bankrupt. The second thing is you've got to get the unions involved. And the first thing that's going to happen is that people will stop buying LA bonds from the city. The state's in worse shape than the city. And my prediction is that next year, come July 1st, they will not be able to sell any bonds, what they call revenue anticipation bonds, to cover the next year. I don't think they'll be able to sell them because nobody knows where they're going to have the revenues to pay them off.
And isn't there an additional complication by the federal cancellation of the Buy American bonds that were designed to encourage buying of municipal debt?
Yeah, there is. I mean, all of a sudden, it's come to a screeching halt just in the last 2 months. I've been predicting it for 2 years now, and I sold all the bonds I had in government because of it. And everything has stayed pretty even on it. But all of a sudden, the last 2 months, there's been a total crisis of selling these bonds. The cost to the city of L.A., almost the cost of their bonds for the one-year bonds, went up about 50% in the last year.
Okay, and that's a pretty good indication that there's not a lot of credit being given to the, there's not
well,
a lot of confidence.
Not a lot of credit, but also a big indication is that people may be afraid to buy those bonds.
Right. In the case of bankruptcies, we've had two fairly recent ones in California. There was Orange County in the early 90s and Vallejo in 2008. Both of those cases, the municipality and the county did not get out of their public sector pension liabilities, which was the real issue. Chapter 9 bankruptcy, which is what municipalities will go into, allows specifically for these contracts to be canceled. So why has no politician had the will to do that yet?
Because they're elected by the unions. In Vallejo, in the state of California, even in Orange County, the unions put more money into elections of politicians than the biggest corporations in the world. And because of that, you go with, like Vallejo, they had to make some changes in particularly the police pensions up there. And the police held out forever, even though the firefighters made a deal with the city. And ultimately, the police union won out, and the politicians were afraid to go ahead without it. So what's going to happen? They're going to face the same problem in another year or two.
Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa just recently broke from pattern. Certainly, he's a longtime union supporter and teachers union member. And yet he has recently been thumping the tub, saying that the teachers are in the way of reform. And what does that mean?
Well, you know, it's curious because I've been out there through in the articles I've had in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and others, very critical of Mayor Villaraigosa, particularly on the pensions and the future, and a lot of other issues like closing the libraries and weekends and at nights. And then he comes up with this incredibly great talk blaming the unions for our poor education system. And I said, hallelujah, I'm going to forget everything I didn't like about him, and I think he's the greatest mayor that ever lived now. Educating children so they have the tools to compete in a high-tech society in the future is the best thing, not only for the children, but for the country. Because we can't compete with other countries. We don't have the young people who can do the high-tech jobs that in India they can do, China they can do, Malaysia they can do.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own experience as a private sector person in the charter school business and so forth?
You know, I sound important, more important than I deserve, but the Alliance for Charter Schools, which has 18 charter schools, the average they do is about 40 or 50% than the schools the kids came from. They do over 800 APIs. And it was founded in 1988 by Helen Bernstein and myself. And Helen was a former head of the teachers union who got religion on reform. And we started with the Alliance a program called LEARN, which was to get more power down at the local school level with the teachers and the parents and everybody. That worked. It didn't work extremely well. It improved things by maybe 8%. And then while I was mayor, Frank Baxter took over as chairman of the Alliance, and the laws were put through Sacramento allowing for charter schools. So Frank changed the emphasis of the Alliance to charter schools. And since then, say we formed 18 charter schools at the Alliance. I took over for Frank when he became, after I was mayor and he became ambassador to Uruguay. And he did a great job. Alliance did a great job. We built a great board of directors. Some of our schools do over 900 API. The vast, vast majority, well over 90%, go to four-year colleges of kids, and 95% of the kids are below poverty. They do much better than Beverly Hills or San Marino or any of those communities. And then last September, I got a call saying that ICEF, which is a group of about 15 charter schools, which is fantastic scholastically, virtually every student is African American. Over 90% of the students end up going to four-year colleges. And that I got a call saying they're about to close because they've run out of money. And what happened is what I call the perfect storm happening at a time when the state had cut down on the money that went into education, and therefore the cash flow to the school had gone down dramatically. The fact that the ICEF grew too fast, and they put a lot of their operation money into building new schools, plus the fact that they just did some stupid things economically. They had run out of money. So about 3 days before the Friday, we had to, they were going to close. Mike Piskel, who founded ICEF, and is to me is a saint, he was a terrible manager, but a saint, came to me begging to see if I could do something, because he had been to the Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation, a number of other big foundations, and they had seen, they said, we don't want to give money down a dark hole, something that's going under. He came to me and clicked my mind. I say two things. One, I can't believe letting these kids go back to schools where only 4% of the kids are going to four-year colleges compared to ICEF that was 90%. And secondly, if ICEF failed, it would reflect on every charter school. It would really hurt the charter school movement. So I said, anything I can do, we should do it, and we should do it now. So with 3 days to go, we raised $3 million to keep the school going that month. Since then, we've gotten that up to over $10.5 million, where we were able to pay those months. And we have enough to get us through December. We need to raise another $2 million for January. And once we're through January, the school will be able to go on its own 2 feet. And I'll maybe if you're interested, I'll tell you why. But the bottom line is they will be able to stand on their own 2 feet.
What's fundraising environment like these days?
Well, it's very, very tough. I mean, it's a lot of the people that I usually rely on said no. And I think it's sort of an experience. I mean, I grew up as a lawyer. I did a lot of near-type bankruptcy work for sick companies. And the one thing you ever really learned is don't put money into a sick company unless they have a total, complete change of management and thing, because they will figure some way to lose that money that you give them. And I think a lot of the really great foundations thought that way. And they said, we're not going to give you any money. You come back a few months from now and prove that you can stand on your own 2 feet. Well, we needed money in the meantime. And so it was tough, but I went out. Eli Broad has came up with $2 million, most of which will come in December. And the Otis Booth Foundation came up with $2 million. I came up with $2 million myself. And a whole bunch of other angels, like the Gates Foundation gave a few hundred thousand. And so we are, we're getting there.
How receptive has the Villaraigosa administration been to charter schools?
Well, they've been mixed. The Villaraigosa was very mixed until he gave that speech and he realized, he has taken over, they call it the mayor's partnership. He finally woke up to the fact that the reason it wasn't competing with ISEF or the Alliance is the union. The unions do not want any accountability. They put incompetent adults ahead of children.
Now, that's the way it works in my family, too. the Democrats have shown some pretty broad disenchantment with teachers' unions and public sector unions in particular of late. And starting with Governor Brown, Governor-elect Brown. What does this mean when you have this broad consensus among the Republicans and the Democrats and the people that these organizations are really taking up too much of our money, standing in the way of reform, and yet nothing changes?
I wouldn't call it a broad consensus yet, because clearly if you take like Sacramento, the legislature there is still overwhelmingly controlled by the unions. But there's been a break in the ice for it, like Villaraigosa coming in, Obama through Arne Duncan, the race to the top has come in. People think that Governor Brown may come in. He had charter school that he supported in Oakland. But the legislators are all there. They're elected because of the unions. They're afraid to vote against the unions. But I'm hoping that what Villaraigosa did could be the atomic bomb that will wake everybody up, particularly poor people, and say, my child has a right to go to college. My child has a right to upward mobility, to be anything they want. I don't want this kind of education.
So talk a little more about the city and its finances. A lot of folks on the left will say that the problem with LA, with California, with the United States, is that the rich are not paying their fair share in taxes. It is the problem that could we solve our financial problems by taxing the rich more?
Well, the answer is absolutely not. And I'm a rich guy, so I can I live extremely well. I do give well over half of my wealth to charities, and particularly for anything dealing with poor children. And a lot of rich people do that. Eli Broad, you look what he's done. Even Bill Gates, who has done it. But it's an interesting problem that people don't understand. They don't want to, a lot of people, is the gap between the rich and the poor has grown every year since 1970. And I think it's growing faster now with technology. The wealthy people like myself control the companies that build technology. And that, I think, gap is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And unless we educate kids to be able to be executives, top employees, and everything in high technology, those kids are going to have nowhere to go. 10 years from now, they'll be poor, they'll be out of job, and they'll probably be revolting unless we figure out some way to solve the problem. You cannot solve the problem by saying, okay, we're going to redistribute, because raising taxes is a way of redistributing the wealth. Every place in the world that's ever tried that has been a dismal failure. You look at England in the 50s, they had a brain drain where the wealthy moved, including the Beatles, moved out of the country. And by the end of the 50s, England was bankrupt. Margaret Thatcher saved them in that time. And you saw Chile under Allende. I mean, God, within a year, he like doubled the income of the poor. And within a year, the whole country was bankrupt.
In the case of L.A., what would be a smarter tax policy? What could we do in the way we collect taxes in L.A. to make the city more competitive?
I think you asked the wrong question. Is how do you make the city more competitive is the right question. And you do it by having a city with bureaucrats and the city council, the mayor, being friendly to business. And we have, since I left office, we have become less and less friendly to business. The bureaucrats take over. You talk to small businesses or any business, it takes them forever to get permits to start a business in L.A. Who wants to start a business in Los Angeles? Forget the amount of taxes. Being a wealthy guy, I don't mind paying more taxes if they're going to do the right thing. But I don't know, if you ever heard of C. Northcote of Parkinson?
Yes, yeah.
He had a magic thing. If the total taxes go over 25%, a lot of bad things happen. The rich can, right now in this internet age, rich can run their company from any place in the world. They don't have to be in California. They don't have to be in the United States. And you make the taxes at a certain point up there. That's what they're doing. Now, to a great extent, they're doing it anyway because California, and particularly LA, are unfriendly to business. And we haven't created an infrastructure, we haven't done virtually nothing for an infrastructure in the last 30 years. And a lot of companies have left. They've expanded. How many Apple and Intel, other companies have expanded outside of the United States or at least outside of California?
Let's speak a little bit. You're talking about infrastructure. It just took me about an hour to drive over here from Hollywood. How important is mobility to a city like LA, and how much is the fairly grueling experience of being on the roads in LA depressing the city's future?
I mean, certainly in deciding whether you're going to locate a business or expand a business, LA traffic is an important ingredient. And I think it's got to be improved, but how much you can improve a city this size, I don't know. You have the city council control the entitlements to build new buildings, zoning, and each councilman essentially is a dictator, because if the other councilmen don't vote for what they want in their district, you won't vote for them in their other district. So essentially the big developers are getting permits to build all these big new condo buildings and everything in areas that shouldn't have, we don't want anybody else living there because it just brings more and more traffic. It gets awfully complicated because, you know, the developers don't make money by putting things in the inner city. You know, there is some public housing that goes there at some astronomical cost, which doesn't make much sense. And you also, complicated thing is you see a lot of gentrifying of the inner city. So you're pushing, like, the number of blacks in LA has been reduced by, I don't know, it's almost 50% in the last 20 years. So it's very complicated. I don't claim to be able to see through walls and predict where we're going to be next year or 2 or 10 years after. But I tell you, as a leader, whoever is in a leadership role ought to be studying this and bringing on the smartest people in the world to help them.
Are the smartest people in the world really going to solve the problem that we're talking about right here? Let's take South LA, where there are a ton of programs that stem from the time of the riots and areas like Marlton Square and the Vermont Manchester Project, and there's some, you know, Broadway, I forget what the cross street is, a lot of huge projects that are fallow to this day. Everybody has looked at them. Everybody has come in with these big plans. The CRA has always been involved. And year after year, they continue to produce literally nothing but prairie land in the middle of Los Angeles. Why is that? wouldn't it be better just to say, let's divide all of this up into a few hundred little lots, sell it to whoever wants to buy it and build a house?
Well, clearly, things like that would definitely be the answer. One of the problems, I mean, it's a problem, it's a fact, is a lot of that land is in the hands of very wealthy people. And they are looking for some magical way that they can make an awful lot more money off projects, particularly by getting government money involved, et cetera. Now, under my administration, we came up with a program called Genesis, which was to try to get the private sector, not public money, but get the private sector into the inner cities and not handcuff them by saying, oh, you have to hire half your employees from the inner city or this, that, and the other. Just do what makes money for everybody, because the inner city needs, they need better grocery stores and things like that there. But the way to get it is not through what I call poverty pimps, but through people that know how to make money and will make money there. And Genesis has done a great, great job. They've actually expanded throughout the country. They've got several $1 billion of developments, and it's improved. Actually, the work they've done has improved it in LA as well as other cities.
Personal question. You're a friend of the legendary comedian Jonathan Winters?
Yeah, he's a great friend.
Has he told you any good jokes lately? Anything on point?
Well, I'm wondering if he's a little crazy sometimes, and he is still going strong. And there's a drugstore and cafe that are all in one business in Montecito that he stays out at. And he's done some outrageous things there, like some woman comes into the drugstore with her husband and says, oh, you're Jonathan Winters. And he said, no, ma'am, no, I'm Dr. Seymour Hirsch. I'm head of the Santa Barbara Health Institute. He said, no, you look just like Jonathan Winters. Well, no, ma'am, I appreciate that. And he said, is that your husband over there? Oh, yeah, that's my husband. You know, he has a terminal disease. But his craziness, he won't let go. It's funny for a second. But
yeah. One more thing on mobility before we get off that. We're in L.A. where... There is the exposition line is going to run from USC, I think, all the way to the beach.
Hopefully.
At street level, it's a street grade train. Now we have this new multi-bazillion dollar plan for the subway, not to the sea, but the subway to the VA hospital. And so when is LA going to get over its train fantasy?
Well, it is a fantasy, although the line to the beach on exposition makes pretty good economic sense because it's infinitely cheaper than a subway. Let me back off. When I was mayor, we went down with Zev Yaroslavsky, Von Burke, and myself went down to Curitiba, Brazil, southern Brazil, where the previous mayor of the city and then the governor of the province it's in, Jaime Lerner, was a Polish-Jewish guy whose family came over in the 1920s to Brazil. They'd been there for years, and was an architect. He was a trained architect, and then his successor, I think it was Tanguchi or something, it was Japanese, the same that come over in the 1930s, was an architect. And they designed, to me, the best designed city in the world per dollar, because it wasn't fancy at all. But they had everything coming into the middle of the city in rungs. Those rungs were dedicated bus lanes where they had tri-articulated buses, which can be doubled and everything, with about 250 people they took, that took off every 70 seconds from the center and went off one of those spokes. The only high rises could be along the bus lanes and no place else. And they also had things that looked like lighthouses in there, all the parks, to show where the parks were. So what we did, we came back and we copied what they did in the valley. We have a 15-mile bus lane there that costs about 3% of what the subway will per mile, and it carry a lot more because...
This is the Orange Line?
The Orange Line. Because what happens is you have only a 70-second difference between one bus and the other. And with subways, you have about a 10 or 15 minute difference. Even though the subway goes faster, you can't take more people. And the one going to the beach or to the VA is crazy. And I don't think it's ever going to happen. I mean, among other things, you got to compete with Beverly Hills and, you know, Santa Monica somewhere along in it. And I don't, even if it's built by some magic at some astronomical price, I don't think it's going to do that much.
Do you have any hope for California as a sort of test case, as this kind of Keynesian interventionist laboratory where we have everything? The Democrats are in control. The Republicans have been extinguished. The threshold for raising taxes has been lowered. The every aspect of human behavior has some regulation over it. There are a million environmental regulations. There's a high-speed rail effort. So how's that all going to end up?
Well, I think the total collapse unless something's done. Now, what's going to happen, not just to California, it's going to happen more in California than others, but throughout the country, 90% of cities, states are going to go bankrupt within the next 5 years, and probably many of them sooner. The big thing is they won't be able to raise money by selling bonds. Nobody wants to lend them money. So the federal government, if Obama wants to get reelected, he's going to face some part of this because some of it will happen before 2012. And you'll have total disarray. The parks will be closed. The libraries will be closed. They'll cut down 25% or more on the number of police. And it'll be a total collapse. And one thing, the Obama administration has not focused on this.
What's your assessment of Governor Schwarzenegger?
He and I, you know, I love the guy, but God, he won't play golf with me anymore.
Why won't the governor play golf with you? I've heard about this.
Can I be totally honest with you?
Yeah.
You're not going to repeat this to your wife or anything?
No, absolutely not.
Would you play golf with somebody who cheats on the scorecard on almost every other hole? Would you?
No, I wouldn't.
Would you play golf with somebody who hits the ball in the woods and it mysteriously ends up in the middle of the fairway? Would you?
No, never. Of course not.
Well, neither will Arnold. What do I think of Arnold?
I appreciate your coming clean on that.
Arnold is, he's a good friend of mine, although we've had differences recently on some of the bonds and things that they wanted to do. Like a year ago, May, I was chairman against voting for all the lottery and all this money they were going to steal. Arnold is extremely brilliant, obviously very charismatic, and a real doer. And I saw him in private life that way, helping inner city causes. He didn't just pay lip service. He would do it, get it done. He got up into Sacramento, where he had all these great ideas, and you had a legislature that was controlled by the unions. So if you wanted to do things on education, the union stopped you, and then he had to make some peace with the unions, and then the Republicans would stop him. And I shouldn't say I feel sorry for him, but because I don't think he feels sorry for himself. I will say, I was Secretary of Education up there for a while, and there were a few things that I would like to have seen done that maybe the governor could do. You go back into the city of L.A., where when I was mayor, it was called a very weak mayoral system. And although I got a new charter into place my second term, which made it a little stronger, but the bottom line is if you have perceived power as mayor, then just use it. Don't let anybody, and don't wait for questions as to whether you have the legal or other right to do it. Mm-hmm. If people perceive you have that power, and if what you're doing is ethical and practical, just do it. Like you've heard the saying, it's much easier to get forgiveness than to get permission. Let's take the earthquake, Northridge earthquake. Literally, I had zero power then legally, because the state constitution provided in emergencies that the county would take over. But I acted like I had all the power. The county never questioned me, the state never questioned me, the federal government never questioned me.
The county, I mean, did they even know there was an earthquake?
Well, come on.
Yeah, I mean, that's surprising to me that I would have thought, I had never studied how the you know, emergency powers were vested, but I would assume that it would go to the mayor, not the county, which has no executive. And
yeah, it would make sense. But,
right, yeah. How about Villaraigosa? What, do you have any thoughts on, I mean, other than turning on the unions?
Well, right now he's on my A-list because of turning on. And I've talked to a lot of the leaders in town, business leaders who are reformists on education, and all of a sudden they're in love with Villaraigosa because he could be the nuclear bomb to really destroy, help us start destroying the power of these unions, where they say they put incompetent people ahead of children. They want no accountability. So I say all the things I've been critical of Villaraigosa on, I've just clear out of my mind now. Right now, I'm hugging him, I'm kissing him, and I'm going to work with him. In fact, I'm meeting with him this afternoon on this whole subject.
Speaking of forgiveness and permission, you've been divorced three times. You're still listed as Roman Catholic. Are you practicing?
Very much so. Yeah, and I've on the Catholic Archdiocese Educational Foundation. And
so, does the church bother about divorce anymore? I mean, I remember it being a big deal breaker.
Well, they make it easier to get back in the church. They do, but they don't, you know, approve of, you know, they don't like divorce. Interestingly enough, one of the girls I'm dating now was my first wife, the mother of my children, Jeannie. And we get along very, very well. And she, much to my amazement, she doesn't remember all my bad things. She remembers my great sense of humor.
I have to very grudgingly admit, as a disgruntled former LA Times staffer, that they have really done some important work in 2010. As you know, I mean, hardly anybody reads it anymore, but it still exercises an enormous amount of influence in local politics and in state politics. Where does the bias show up in the LA Times? Can you give me some examples of maybe from your own administration?
Well, when I'm in administration, I was running for office, there was a reporter from a Dallas newspaper followed me around one day from house to house, and I was in some house in LA, and there was this woman in her 90s was there, and we sat down and chatted with the reporter, and you know, finally she said something like, you know, blacks are terrible. And my response was, well, you know, some of them are. And, you know, I wasn't going to come out and hit her in the nose or something. And so this reporter in a her article's on three pages, in the very back page near the end, talks about this little capsule. The LA Times, the front page, A section, and headlines, starts out with that and say, people accuse Reardon of racism. Now, it made me angry, and it's still, and I think about it. And they were trying to find almost anything to, you know, there's no way a rich white Republican can care about the poor. And but I will say that I've had hundreds and hundreds of Democrats come up to me and say, I'm the first Republican I've ever voted for because I do care about poor kids. And to me, that was the most important goal as mayor, was to help poor children.
What was it like when you were growing up? What's your background?
I went to a primary school, kindergarten through second grade, where 50% of my classmates were black. And interestingly enough, compared, they were the equal of the whites, I mean, scholastically. And even though I lived in a middle to upper middle class neighborhood, on one side of the woods, on the other side were the blacks with these very poor housing. But, you know, they did well in school. We got along. I got along with their parents. They got along with mine. Although I thought 10 years later, I thought, you know, our parents never met. each other.
Yeah.
But my parents, who had, you know, average amount of bigotism at the time, never once said anything.
One other thing on the LA Times, and is the bias that we're talking about, is it really on, sometimes it's on particular politicians, but the overall kind of momentum of the institution is always in favor of government intervention and against any sort of private sector initiative. Why is that? Especially since it's one of the few non-union papers in the country.
Well, it really is union. I mean, the sense that they give an awful lot not to be union. They pay out more than they should. And I think it's, well, obviously it's the average reporter is very liberal. And you have, you know, reporters that graduated from Columbia Journalism School and others tended to be, their professors at the school were liberal. They tended to be very liberal, and it just cut through the whole system. And after Otis Chandler came in and said, okay, we're going to give power to the reporters and everything, everything changed. Where before, one person at the top could say, you're going to put everything conservative in the newspaper.
Do you think that that the paper actually lost some influence by doing that? Because it seems to me, I was a big, when I was there, I used to love their archive system and just look and read these crazy editorials from back in the old days. And, you know, it was the paper that made Nixon up until Otis came in. Now, yeah. Otis comes in, turns it into this nationally competitive paper, but actually kind of, in a lot of ways, reduced the influence of the paper. It's just another, it's like, it's another thing behind the New York Times.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of things. But I think particularly the conservatives in town are among the wealthier, generally, and they stopped taking the LA Times. You know, they lost a constituency. At minimum, they could have had more, you know, right wing, left wing, or, you know, give both sides of the equation. Now, the New York Times is worse than the LA Times that way, and even they're hurting now very badly.
Let's look back, since we're speaking about the institution of newspapers, but think back a little bit. You come in as mayor in 1993. At the time, nobody's on the internet. Riots have just happened. The LA Times and the entertainment, Goliaths are all at the peak of their powers. You know, how would you stack up, you know, your own mayoralty against where LA is today?
Of the world, and that's what you're asking me, because, you know, I can sound to say, well, I was the greatest mayor in the history of the world. And if I had any brilliance, it was the ability to hire the best and the brightest people and to empower them. The word empowerment, very few politicians know how to empower other people. But if you empower people and you say, like I told my average staff, even right down to the middle or lower middle, when you come in every morning, think, what can I do to make LA a better city? Not what's going to make the mayor look good or what I agree on. And by doing that, you attract better and better people around you because they say, oh, you're empowered. We can get things done. And we did. We got tremendous things done. And particularly for business, I mean, getting down to where 95% of permitting could have been done on the internet in 5 minutes. And the others within less than, you know, 2 or 3 months, where it might have taken years before.
What happened with that, I mean, since then?
You had mayors that didn't know how to empower people and essentially surround themselves with very mediocre people. And I think what happens is the bureaucrats just sort of drifted off in whatever direction they wanted.
LA's political class, and it's almost entirely Democratic at this point, is really, I mean, it's a south of the Mason-Dixon line level of politics in a way that I think would shock Americans in other places. Is there any hope for just LA's political class, and maybe specifically for the Republicans? Is there anything that can happen to kind of shake things up?
You know, you would think so, that because usually, the Republicans go towards the middle, the Democrats go towards the middle, and you get a pretty balanced type legislature, but it hasn't happened. It's gotten worse, as you point out. And where it's going to be, I don't know. But if there's disaster in the city, are the politicians going to change? or the public going to realize we have to elect different people? I hope it's the latter.
You had a privatization initiative when you were mayor. Maybe hasn't gone too far since you've left office. What areas of LA government are ripe for privatization?
Well, I mean, you start out with that you have 99% of the elected officials in LA were supported by the unions, and they're not about, and privatizations to a great extent would indicate that the unions are going to lose a lot of power. Now, therefore, I don't feel great hope for the future, but with that, as the budget gets more and more trouble, some of the solutions may, the only solutions may be privatization. So they might do that just for that reason, to get out of going into bankruptcy, is like privatize the airport, the ports, other places like that. It's certainly, with the way the public employees have just gobbled up every penny of taxes and everything in the country, it seems to me that it's about the only way out of this morass is to privatize.